Welcome to the OT08 season of SCOTUSCast. On Monday, October 6th, the Supreme Court officially opened the October 2008 term by hearing oral argument in Altria Group v. Good, and today our featured guest is University of Illinois Professor of Law Andrew Morris. Thanks for tuning in. This case arises from an attempt by three longtime smokers of light cigarettes to sue the cigarette manufacturers under Maine's Fair Trade Practices Act, claiming that the manufacturers knew all along that light cigarettes would not deliver less tar or nicotine to the smoker. The federal district court dismissed the case, reasoning that it was based on health hazard claims preempted expressly by the Federal Cigarette Labeling and Marketing Act and impliedly by Federal Trade Commission policy. The First Circuit reinstated the lawsuit, rejecting both claims of preemption, and now the Supreme Court considers the question of whether federal law in fact preempts such state law challenges to FTC-authorized statements in cigarette advertising, either expressly or impliedly. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, for the opening episode of the OT08 SCOTUSCast season, Professor Morris.
Today I'm going to talk about Altria Group Incorporated versus Stephanie Good, a case that was argued for the Supreme Court on October 6, 2008. Now, this case involves a group of plaintiffs who sued Philip Morris and Philip Morris's parent company, Altria, alleging that they had smoked Marlboro Lights for 15 or more years because of the unfair and deceptive trade practices of Philip Morris in advertising Marlboro Lights as lower in tar and nicotine than regular cigarettes. And they allege that Philip Morris did this despite knowing that the actual amount of tar and nicotine from a light cigarette was no less to the smoker than a smoker would receive from a regular cigarette. And the reason they claim this is true is that smokers smoking light cigarettes engage in behavior called compensation. They put their lips over the little holes in a cigarette that draw air into the filter and reduce the amount of tar and nicotine. They take longer, deeper breaths. They take more frequent puffs from the cigarette, and they use their fingers to unconsciously perhaps cover the holes in the cigarette, thus minimizing the additional airflow. And they allege that Philip Morris knew that this behavior was going on, and as a result, the test results under the method called the Cambridge method, by which the content of the tar and nicotine content of a cigarette are measured, were an inaccurate reflection of the actual tar and nicotine received by the smoker. Now, the issue in this case is whether or not the Federal Cigarette Labeling and Advertising Act, or FCLAA, a 1965 statute, preempts state law claims over these allegedly deceptive trade practices by Philip Morris. And Philip Morris persuaded the Federal District Court, where the suit was filed, to grant it summary judgment on the preemption grounds. The plaintiffs then got this reversed by the First Circuit. The Fifth Circuit had previously found preemption in a similar case, and there was now a circuit split, and the Supreme Court accepted jurisdiction on the case. There's quite a history to tobacco regulation that's relevant to this, and you could read about that in 2008, a University of Illinois Law Review article at page 1225 that I co-authored with Bruce Yandel, Andrew Dorchak, and Joseph Rotundi, called Bootleggers, Baptists, and Televangelists, Regulating Tobacco by Litigation. I also have a shorter version of that in the most recent issue of Regulation Magazine. Now, there are two interesting wrinkles to this case. The first is that the FCLAA, at the time it was passed, was seen as a great victory for the tobacco companies. One analyst called it a severe rebuke to the FTC. Another referred to it as one of the dirtiest deals ever done in Congress. And there was an Amici brief filed by some public health experts in this case, which called the bill essentially the bill presented to Congress by the tobacco industry, and says that, suggesting that the law deserved perhaps less deference than other regulatory statutes. So we might expect a more unfriendly attitude toward the FCLAA compared to court's attitudes towards, say, the Clean Air Act, which isn't seen as much as a something produced by some sort of unholy alliance of interest groups bargaining and getting Congress to ratify it. The second interesting wrinkle in this is the role of state attorney generals. In our work, my co-authors and I call the state attorney generals televangelists, in a Bootleggers and Baptist coalition. Bruce Yandel had a 1983 article on regulation suggesting that there are coalitions between bootleggers who want to expand their market and Baptists who want to see the marketing of alcohol restricted to produce something like Sunday closing laws that we see in many states, and that this alliance was an implicit one in favor of some regulatory measures. The bootleggers like Sunday closing laws because it restricts competition for their product, and the Baptists like it because it furthers the moral purpose that they want. The combination gives the bootleggers a legitimate reason for state legislators to vote in favor of the bootlegger-favored measure, and so the Baptists provide sort of moral cover for the special interest groups. Televangelists, in our expansion of this, are people who are not true believers, so they're not actually seeking to propose legislation that advances something they believe in, but they're just opportunists joining in. And we argued that the state attorney generals played that role in the tobacco litigation in the 1990s that led up to the master settlement agreement between 46 states and the tobacco companies. And that settlement, the master settlement agreement, led to has produced a payout of about $246 billion over 25 years for the states. So there's a lot of money at stake here, and the state attorney generals see litigating against tobacco companies as something that's very politically popular and something that produces large amounts of revenue for their states. As a result, 48 state attorney generals and the District of Columbia's attorney general joined in an Amici brief in this case. Every state's attorney general but Virginia and North Carolina's supporting the plaintiffs in trying to preserve their authority to bring actions against the tobacco companies. Now, there were two main issues in this case. They dealt with express and implied preemption. The implied preemption issue got almost no attention during oral arguments, so we're going to treat it as not particularly important. And it does seem clear from the argument that the case is going to come down to the express preemption. So I'm going to focus on that. Now, Ted Olson argued the case for Philip Morris, David Frederick for the respondents, and the Solicitor General's office appeared through Douglas Halward Dremier. Now, Olson's argument was essentially this. He argued that the FCLAA completely preempts anything to do with the relationship between smoking and health. So states cannot make any sort of law, either through regulations or through the common law, that deals with the relationship between smoking and health. And he got a few questions about this, about whether or not there was any room left for state action, and questions about why Congress might have preempted false statements about smoking and health. But in general, the justices seemed pretty sympathetic to Olson's arguments and pressed him mostly on whether or not he saw there was any state role left in dealing with false advertising by tobacco companies. But he had a pretty relatively easy time of it in this case. Now, the attorney for the respondents, Mr. Frederick, didn't have quite so easy a time of it, and the justices really pressed him on a couple questions. They wanted to know primarily from him how he could make a claim that didn't relate to the relationship between smoking and health. Now, remember, his client's claim is that they were tricked into buying light cigarettes rather than perhaps regular cigarettes, or rather than buying no cigarettes at all by the deceptive trade practices of the cigarette company. And most of the questions that he got from the justices really focused on whether or not there was a connection between health and his client's claims. In fact, Justice Kennedy explicitly asked him whether he would accept an amendment to his complaint that he's not seeking damages based on a link between smoking and health. And Mr. Frederick responded, yes. This led to an extended dialogue between him and Justice Souter, who said, basically, how can you do that? There's no real basis for any damage claim unless you're saying that the deception led people to do something that wasn't related that led them to have experienced poorer health. And he tried to make a, Frederick in response tried to make a claim saying, well, it's as if I wanted to buy a Ford and I was offered a Yugo instead, deceptively. And the response to that then from Justice Scalia was, well, what if Yugos and Fords are worth the same amount of money? Where are the actual damages here? And these questions were quite pointed. They weren't just coming from Justice Scalia or someone else that you might expect it from, but also from Justices Kennedy and Souter and Breyer. Indeed, Breyer said at one point, I just can't deal with this. It was hard for me to see it conceptually. I can't understand how this language could be interpreted not to relate to health claims. The justices also pressed him on the issue of whether or not a state attorney general could issue regulations prohibiting statements about tar and nicotine or requiring statements saying that the method of calculating the tar and nicotine contents was misleading. And again, he didn't seem to have much luck in persuading even justices we might think would be sympathetic to his point of view, like Justice Ginsburg. And Justice Kennedy, after that extended colloquy, went on to say, Mr. Frederick, if I can take away from your oral argument that it is your position that this suit is not based on a link between smoking and health, I'm going to have difficulty in accepting your position in this entire case. He's having a lot of trouble even with justices that he might think have thought going into the case might be more sympathetic. If we go back and look at an earlier Supreme Court case, Cipollone versus Liggett Group from 1992, 505 U.S. 504, there was a split in the court with a plurality of four justices, just joining an opinion by Justice Stevens, Justice White, Justice O'Connor, and Chief Justice Rehnquist, a two-judge concurrence with Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, and then a dissent by Justices Blackmun, Kennedy, and Souter. And in Cipollone, this also dealt with preemption, and the plurality opinion being the sort of deciding thing between the more extreme positions of the dissent and the Scalia concurrence, those four votes would be critical to get a majority in this case for the plaintiffs. And they're going to need all of Kennedy, Souter, Breyer, Ginsburg, and Stevens to put together a majority in this case. They're certainly not going to get Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas based on their opinion in Cipollone. And they're very unlikely to get Chief Justice Roberts or Justice Alito based on the questions. Both of those justices seem quite sympathetic to the need for preemption. Now, since Souter and Kennedy both had joined the dissent in Cipollone, one might think those would be the most sympathetic. But again, both were extremely skeptical of the plaintiff's theory in their questions. Stevens would be a much harder vote to get, I think, based on his having authored the plurality decision in Cipollone. And again, he was also very skeptical in his questioning. Perhaps the most likely votes that could be picked up by the plaintiffs, the respondents in this case, would be Justices Breyer and Ginsburg. But even they seemed very, very skeptical, and not in a sort of testing the best arguments of the other side kind of way, but more in, are you really making that argument because I don't get it sort of way. Now, as I mentioned, the Solicitor General's lawyer also made an appearance in this case, and he had barely opened his mouth before the Chief Justice asked him essentially why the United States had not taken a position on express preemption but focused its arguments on implied preemption, and almost all of his time was spent attempting to avoid taking a position on express preemption under repeated questioning from several of the justices. And the remainder of the Solicitor General's time went to a discussion about trying to understand what the FTC's position might be on this. Justice Alito referred to it as incomprehensible, and Justice Scalia has some particularly tough questions about when the FTC knew that there might be problems with the method of calculating tar and nicotine, and suggesting that it was back into the 1970s when the agency knew about it and that the agency had done nothing about it, and that put the companies in a difficult position. So what's going to happen in this case? I think it's a very tough road to get to five votes for the respondents, for the plaintiffs. I would not be surprised to see a final decision 7-2 or better for Philip Morris, but then you never know with the Supreme Court. So we'll be looking forward to finding out what happens this coming spring.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.